You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity. Tonight, we're going to give you a feature, and that feature is insight into the panel of the conference back in November, where the conversation centered around the AI arms race and national security. The moderator of that panel is a former guest on the podcast, committee member and wonderful woman, Margaret Hugh. And the guests on the panel were Aaron Cooper, partner and founding co-chair of Critical and Emerging Technologies Practice at Jenner and Block. Margaret, of course, who is the Davidson Douglas Professor and Law Director of the Digital Democracy Lab at William & Mary Law School. Kat Duffy, who's a Senior Fellow for Digital and Cyberspace Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Josh Hodges, who's a partner at Ridgeline Advocacy Group. And William Hudson, who's Associate General Counsel of Anthropic. Rumor afoot, they are about to do an IPO. So what was this conversation about? Russian leader Vladimir Putin has predicted that the ruler of artificial intelligence will be the ruler of the world. And he made this announcement in 2017. I'm not sure we should listen to him about that much, but it did feel like a throwdown, like he was trying to analogize the AI race to the space race. So the conversation centered around that. The panel was great. Margaret's always great. We will link in the notes to the cast some of the reading for those of you who are overachievers. And that is the reading that was given out at the conference and is something that for your self-study for CLE, if you're a California bar member, you can certainly petition them and see if that'll get you some credit because they're pretty good about that when you do the work. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much to the ABA and the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. This is such a privilege to moderate this next panel on the AI arms race and national security. My name is Margaret Hu, and I'm a professor of law at William & Mary Law School. And especially given this moment in history, this is such a critically important topic. And I am humbled to introduce this panel. The depth of expertise here is staggering. So I'm going to first start to my speaker on the left, Aaron Cooper. He is a co-chair of the Data Privacy and Cybersecurity Practice at Jenner and Block, and he is the chair of the Critical and Emerging Technologies Practice. Previously, he served as the Deputy Legal Advisor for the White House National Security Council and a lead Senate Intelligence Committee Investigative Counsel and a cybercrime prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice. Then, further to my left is Kat Duffy. She is a senior fellow for digital and cyberspace policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and the founder and CEO of Right Stuff Strategies. She was a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab, where she directed the Task Force for a Trustworthy Future Web. And she has served with the U.S. Department of State and the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees, and currently serves on the World Economic Forum's Global Futures Council on Geopolitics. Then next, we have Josh Hodges, who is a partner at Ridgeline Advocacy Group, where he leads the advocacy group's defense technology practice. Previously, he served as White House National Security Advisor, also served as National Security Advisor to the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and Senior Director of the National Security Council during the first Trump administration, and also Deputy Senior Director for Information Statecraft for the NSC. He was National Security Advisor in the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives for over a decade. And then finally, we have Will Hudson, Associate General Counsel at Anthropic. And previously, he spent a decade working at Google in legal policy and operations and has served as Director for International Cyber Policy at the National Security Council and as Senior Associate General Counsel at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. So please join me in welcoming our fantastic panel today. So first, I wanted to kick off the panel by setting the table with what do we mean by being engaged in this moment in an AI race, and following up on the theme from last year, the current state of the great power competition. So I wanted to open it with Aaron and Kat. How do we craft AI innovation leadership globally while also protecting national security? And how do we, in this very complex AI economy and AI revolution, how do we assess who is a foreign adversary? Aaron, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thanks, Margaret. And thanks for wrangling us all together for this panel, which I'm excited to be a part of. So I think that question, how to craft that kind of policy, is one of the defining moments of this time. So I think consecutive administrations have identified leadership in frontier AI as a national security imperative. And I think that brings with it some interesting dualities. And one of those is that on the one hand, the United States is focused on innovating at the edge, right, and maintaining our leadership in the most capable artificial intelligence systems. And on the other hand, we also want to make sure that U.S. AI becomes the foundation of global artificial intelligence. And so how do you mediate between those two things, where you want to sort of protect the leadership of U.S. technology, but also make sure it is widely available amongst your partners and allies? And the reason there is a tension, I think, is because once you start to diffuse that technology globally, in the interest of bringing along, you know, our partners with our AI systems, it becomes more easily available to our adversaries. So for example, if you diffuse model weights of the most capable models overseas, those can be fairly easily jailbroken by a sophisticated adversary and used against us. If you build a data center with the most advanced semiconductors overseas, a foreign adversary could likely train its very capable models there. And it can do all of those things then to free itself from and compete with, you know, the U.S., I think, edge and monopoly on the most capable AI systems. And so I think that, you know, this is the challenge, right? So on the one hand, you want to lead. On the other hand, you want to bring our allies and partners along with us, and you want to prevent our adversaries from outcompeting us. And so I think there are obviously different ways to draw that line, and each of those have trade-offs. And we've seen different choices being made over, you know, the last couple of years. But I think to put a finer point on it, like, why does it matter? I actually think the recent news that Anthropic announced, right, sort of illustrates this quite well, which is that, you know, the Chinese used agentic AI capabilities through Anthropic to try to develop malware and use malware for cyber attacks. And the reason we know about that is because the Chinese were using a U.S. Platform to do so. They didn't have the capabilities, apparently, to do it on their own, and they were not using a Chinese-based model. Otherwise, we would have no idea. But the fact that we have U.S. leadership and the edge in technology, and the Chinese need to use American companies to accomplish those goals, I think illustrates quite well why having U.S. leadership in this space is so important, even as we try to bring the rest of the world along with us.
Thank you so much, Kat.
Sure. I mean, I would say I think it's always wise to start the conversations with about artificial intelligence with a little bit of grounding of what do we even mean by the term. Right? I think anyone who talks about national security probably feels the same way. You're always like, what national security are we defining in this moment? But I would suggest that when we say artificial intelligence, you know, what you're really thinking about is an all-purpose technology that operates as an accelerant. And so if you think of AI as a stack, which is how I do, you're going to be thinking about it everywhere from, you know, critical minerals, supply chains, chip production, power grids, data. The way that you talk about those types of things and where we have foreign adversaries or where we have national security concerns is very different from the way that you're going to talk about, like, the deployment of frontier models or the use of open-weighted models or cybersecurity attacks. So I just want to say first and foremost that I find in any of these conversations, if you're talking to someone about AI, it's helpful to just be grounded, to be like, when you're saying AI, what do you mean? Let's have the same conversation. When we're talking about the rise, I think, of generative AI tools, in particular in frontier models, which is where a lot of people's brains are going, I think. I think that there's going to be areas where it operates as an accelerant for the work of foreign adversaries, and I think there are also areas where it can act as an accelerant for unlikely partnerships and unlikely alliances, because it is scaling also different problems that have more collective, where there's more collective interest in solving them. So you're seeing, for example, that while we're seeing exponential increases in fraud and scam through generative AI tools coming out of scam centers in Southeast Asia, which is hitting rural American citizens to the tune of more than $10 billion a year right now. Those same attacks are occurring in countries all over the world. Japan's elderly are also facing this. And so we don't think about this so much from the national security perspective in terms of like militaries or major incursions into our systems, but that is an area where we have seen, for example, the US and China collaborate on dealing with those scam centers. We've seen much stronger and effective action than when China or the US has just gone unilaterally. And so I do think that this is also an interesting moment. We can look at the rise of how different AI applications are occurring and say, okay, well, this is what problem is this creating, but also what unforeseen opportunity is this creating, and how could we be re-examining this or leaning into that potential avenue? And so that's where I tend to get a little bit hesitant about the way that we think about foreign adversaries in a traditional manner, because there's very little about this moment that feels traditional in terms of how the use cases are going to evolve.
Thank you so much, Kat, and I really appreciate that point about how we might be in an ahistorical moment and what that means as far as opportunities and challenges.
My kingdom for precedented times.
And so I'd like to now turn to Josh and Will. So what kind of AI policy should the U.S. pursue to position itself for success in national security strategies geopolitically, and what does it really mean to win in the AI race?
So first of all, thanks for the question. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's nice to see a lot of friendly faces. Put simply, you know, leading, what does success mean for the United States here means that humanity has safely transitioned to a very weird and transformative technology. It's important that when that happens, in our view, that the folks that win are the United States and closely allied democracies, given the potentially transformative impact that these technologies are going to have on almost every part of society. I think in our view, the United States is ahead in this race, but the race is not over, and the opportunity for other actors to catch up and surpass us is a very real one. Winning and staying ahead will depend on the U.S. making a couple key policy choices, and I would sort of break them into three different buckets. One of which is domestic infrastructure. The power consumption of these technologies are immense, and the investments in that infrastructure in the United States have just not been very high over the preceding years, and so there's some work to do there. I think that's been sort of well-trodden ground, but it's an important one to remember. The other one are export controls. I think it's critically important to keep advanced compute out of adversary hands, and in our view, well-enforced trip restrictions play an important role in making sure that we end up not in a bipolar AI world, but in a unipolar AI world where democracies are ahead. And then finally, safety, which I think will be a consistent theme that we talk about today. Government adoption needs to be rapid, it needs to be safe. Private sector adoption needs to be rapid, and it needs to be safe. And safety means that you need to have made a series of policy and legal choices about mitigating risks that is well-informed. And right now, I think understanding of the risk is still fairly uneven. And so I think there's a role for particularly the developers of these technologies to be transparent about the risks that they're seeing. I understand our report that we issued yesterday may have come up yesterday in the discussion, but I think that is consistent with the kinds of behaviors that we think are important, that again, this is a very weird, transformative technology, and the folks in the labs have a little bit of a sneak peek about how weird and transformative it's going to be. In our view, they have a responsibility to keep society and policymakers informed about those risks so that sensible policy choices can be made. So I'll go with that.
Thanks. Part of the reason I wanted Will to go first was because I think from a consideration of sort of what...
Is that better?
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Part of the reason I wanted Will to go first was because from a policy perspective, again, having background in sort of the executive in Congress, including sort of the senior-most congressional office in charge of everything related to national security that has sort of an overarching view, it's imperative, from my perspective, to follow the business community. And to put it simply, we've got to put America first, and the model is simple. We've got to start investing. For too long, the United States has, from a policy perspective, really just waited, and I think people are starting to finally wake up. We're seeing reindustrialization efforts underway. Frankly, China has been prioritizing this for far too long without the United States actually competing. And so unlike other areas such as space, where we already had a head start, we are starting at this from roughly the same point. Fortunately, U.S. innovation has been winning. And that there is a false narrative out there that Chinese innovation is kicking Americans' butts. The reality is U.S. innovation is leading and continues to lead. And I think that was one of the sort of subplots that I read in that story yesterday was the fact that it's an American tech company that's actually innovating and most far out, which I think is to their credit. And so from a policy perspective, I would say we've got to start actually move away from a reactive posture. We've got to start making those investments, not just sort of for core industrial needs, but for future needs. And biotechnology is an area where I think the Chinese and other countries are already recognizing future capabilities that are very soon going to be rapidly available to people who have AI. And it's not just the LLM models that are of concern, it's what comes next and those applications. And that's part of the story that was out yesterday. And so that's from a policy perspective, we have to start looking at how these applications are happening. I know many of you are sort of in the legal profession here. And so as you're looking at this, it's not just questions from the cybersecurity realm that are going to need to be answered, it's from all the other national security realms as well. As if a foreign actor is using American tools to build their stack, how do we combat that? How do we address that in a legal manner? And the other thing, I'll just make a plug here, is from the sort of third pillar that I would put in here is the United States has to stop fueling our adversaries' growth. And we're doing that whether it's from components or financing. And there's two pieces of legislation, which I'll get into in a little while and a bit further. But one of them is the GAIN Act, which would prioritize American companies to get these needed components. The other is the Outbound Investment Act. And that would prohibit American firms and companies from funding Chinese efforts to develop these type of critical technologies. Both of those are happening right now on a widespread basis, and it's enabling our adversary to actually gain on us. And so I would encourage everyone to go get familiar with those pieces of legislation.
Thank you so much. Yes, we're in such a rapidly changing landscape, and we find ourselves in a moment of a great complexity in how we manage our laws in light of the fact that these applications are so widespread. So I wanted to turn to Kat. And yesterday, building upon many of the conversations when we were discussing balancing this real desire to maintain national security dominance and geopolitical and economic dominance through technological innovation. But how do we also maintain our commitment to the rule of law and our commitments to our constitutional democratic republic? Can democratic countries maintain an edge on AI in light of these the balance that we have in front of us?
Yeah, I think, you know, the difference between innovation and transformation rests in deployment, right? Like, you can have all the theoretical capabilities in the world in a lab, and if they're not operating in society and they're not being used, if that system is not the one that's being adopted, then that system is not actually the system driving transformation. I think one of America's greatest strategic advantages doesn't actually sit with our frontier developers. I think it sits with the vast ecosystem that we have of auditors, third-party experts, researchers, multinationals, particularly in highly regulated industries, that have figured out how to operate across a vastly fragmenting, like, regulatory system globally. And I would say around the world, I think, I don't know how long this will hold, honestly, but I think for the most part, people would still rather buy American products or American systems. And that's because those products are seen as good quality, reliable, trustworthy, and also having concepts of due process and accountability behind them. And so One of the things that I think when we think about sort of how do we get behind this in full force, which I completely agree with, it isn't just about investing in particular areas, I think, and it's also not just about slowing down our adversaries, but it is about getting very clear on the fact that whatever systems are going to be adopted globally, those systems will become the underpinning, and the values encoded in those systems will become the underpinning of what the AI transformation looks like. And if the Chinese systems are cheaper, faster, and reasonably decent for purpose, and China has a much better and stronger model right now for marketing and selling and deploying technology at a large scale than we do as a nation. We have individual companies that are great at it, but at a national level, China is much stronger in this regard. Most companies, most governments are going to want systems where they can do auditing. They're going to want to have systems where they can check and see what went wrong. They're going to want systems where they understand the data provenance. And I think many of them aren't actually going to want open-weighted systems for any particularly critical uses, because it's the same way. I mean, how many people in here loved using an open source operating system over Apple or Microsoft? How many lawyers here really love to spin up a Linux system? Uh-huh. Where are my people at? Yeah, exactly. There's two of us, right? Yes, precisely. I think that's going to be the same dynamic. And so we need to make sure that individual rights, that due process, that accountability, that verifiability, that trust, that these are things that are encoded and hardwired into our systems and into the architecture of these systems as quickly as we possibly can. In the same way that, and I think of this because I came from internet governance, in the same way that for 20 years the U.S. maintained a very clear foreign policy that the internet would be free, open, interoperable, and secure. And that interoperability is what allows VPNs to still work in China. Right? It's what has allowed us to continue to get information in and out of incredibly closed societies. And so we need to make sure that the AI systems that we are exporting are also strong and rigorous and will allow for those same types of what I would think of as fundamental American, fundamental democratic principles, which comes back, in my mind, to due process, rule of law, transparency, accountability.
Thank you so much, Kat. So continuing that line of discussion on what some people frame as the launch of an AI cool war with China, I wanted to turn to Josh. And Putin famously said, whoever rules AI will rule the world. Are we in the midst of a Cold War, Cool War type of dynamic with China? Is DeepSeek a Sputnik moment? And are we able to make sure that these Chinese models that are now widely accessible can be trusted, or are they not to be trusted for national security purposes?
Great question, and perfect segue from what Kat was just talking about. I'll take the second question first. I think, so last week there were a number of foreign leaders in town. I met with a few of them, and I heard from multiple, I'm not going to disclose who they are, folks, heads of state, talking about this issue. And the reason they wanted to come to the U.S. and the reason they are revisiting their government's longstanding position related to some of our adversaries is related to this question. They know that they have to leverage AI for the future. They're investing in that. They're innovating towards that. But they want to do it with American technology because they agree with the underpinning and the values that are part of that bottom stack. And that is a key motivation for them, which opens up, from a geopolitical standpoint, an opportunity for the United States to engage with that, again, can help sort of rewrite decades of past relationships with some of our adversaries and with some of these countries. And so if we do this right, it's not just about sort of the technology and are they going to use more reliable, trusted technology. They're going to have better relationships with the United States, and they view that as a win-win because we are the partner of choice, and we are, frankly, everyone wants to do business with the United States, not just because of our economy, but because of the values that we uphold, and everyone sees that. We can have disagreements from year to year on different sort of topics, but ultimately they know in the long run what the United States stands for, and that's something they can bank on. And so I from my perspective, that's kind of that first part of the question. On the DeepSeek, I challenge this, and I think it's a false narrative that the United States cannot outcompete China. But more importantly, that innovation was not a shock to me. Given my perch, I had lots of available information. I recognized sort of why a lot of people were surprised by it. I think some people overplayed it intentionally to try to make it seem like, oh, we should be, and I think part of this gets back to the export controls discussion. But largely, that innovation that China did was done by scaling on the backs of American companies operating across the American AI stack. It could not have been achieved without it. It could not have been achieved without American chips. And so I really view this not as a Sputnik moment, but as a moment to wake up to the reality that the United States and our company, a lot of companies here in the United States, continue to fuel the growth of our main adversary in this realm. And so that, to me, should be a wake-up call from that policy perspective, not sort of the fact that China is out-innovating us. To your first question, or to the first part of your question, on the race, this is absolutely a race. The Chinese, for the past 5 years, have been prioritizing this. The United States has been leaving it to the private sector to compete in this space. And ultimately, I do think there will be a winner. I don't think it's going to be sort of a, you know, the Berlin Wall type of winner. I think it's going to be much more subtle than that. But ultimately, I do think the United States can compete here, can out-innovate here, and we can win that.
Thank you so much. And I think that raises the question that we're not in a typical battlefield. The AI battlefield looks very, very different. And I wanted to turn to Aaron in light of the fact that the digital economy is so international and integrated, and our infrastructure doesn't really recognize boundaries. We have so many issues involving cross-border data flows. So what does international cooperation for the United States look like, and how do we collaborate effectively with our foreign partners?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, again, it flows from the conversation thus far, where there are a couple of different threads that are being woven together, you know, on this particular issue. So, you know, I think when we think about U.S. leadership and our global partnerships, I think there are a couple of things that jump out to me. One is, you know, you want to have systems that are developed in a way that is consistent with U.S. policy priorities. And so that means that in terms of, you know, developing the technology, you know, whether it's auditable, whether it's accountable, things like that, those are really important values, and you want to find ways to build, you know, to ensure that our partners and allies are making those same choices in terms of the systems they develop or the systems that they use. And the other piece of it is with respect to governments and the adoption of these systems, right, you want to make sure that our international partners and allies are adopting these AI tools in a way that is consistent with our policy preferences. And so that means slightly different than the, is the system auditable and can we trust it? It means, is the government going to use it for indiscriminate mass surveillance? Mm-hmm. Or is the government going to use it in a way that is, again, accountable, transparent, right, things that are consistent with the way we view governance in the United States? I think that's sort of one key piece of this, is that we recognize those two parts of the international engagement paradigm. I think a third piece is, how do we get there, right? And I think there are obviously a lot of views on ways to leverage U.S. influence, hard power, soft power, you know, what have you. I think this is one where we have to make a value case, a value proposition, right? That the U.S. approach is the right approach. That in the long run, this will be, you know, provide for more trustworthy and valuable artificial intelligence, utilization within a country. And so I think we can do that in a couple of ways. I think going back to trust and security, that's incredibly important. With Huawei and sort of rip and replace kinds of issues right now, like, we're a little bit behind the times on that. But if you can make that argument on the front end and make clear what the value is on the front end, then you can get ahead of that challenge, further on down the line. And then I think you also need to make the point that, you know, a sustainable governance structure with Western democracies is promoted by a certain kind of implementation of artificial intelligence. And that's the other piece that I think we need to be on the front foot for. So I think those, to me, are some of the key aspects of international engagement. I think how you get there is sort of the other question. And so it might be using our advantage right now, our edge in both the models and access to that technology, but also our edge in the semiconductors and the chips that are available, right? That's an area where the United States has a very clear technological advantage that we've been trying to leverage for some time. And so there are resources we have that we can make available to our partners and use that to sort of bring them along with us. And then I think we can, you know, educate them. Right? So if they have a choice as between AI systems that are built on Chinese technology that are not safe or secure and that can be manipulated for espionage, right? We can make that argument to them, and hopefully that will sort of make up the value difference. So I think those are the kinds of arguments we want to make. I think there are different forums to do that in. I think we should, of course, look to and have looked to different international bodies to engage on norms building. I think that'll be a long-term project.
Great, thank you so much. So building on what Kat said, that looking at multilateral approaches might be one pathway forward, and what you just said about building these types of cooperative international arrangements in order to try to lead in AI, and also what you said, Josh, about needing to make sure that we understand that this truly is a race. I wanted then to turn to Will. And how do we really understand and crystallize the risks? And I think I speak for all of us to say we are so grateful that you're here, especially in light of the week that you've had and the last few days that you've had. But we had this morning the first panel talking about autonomous issues with especially drone warfare. And for many years, this body has been discussing some of the issues, legal issues, and ethical issues involving lethal autonomous weapons. But now we're in a new world with these autonomously deployed AI-driven cyber attacks. But would love to hear your thoughts on how do we fully grasp and ground the risks in this AI race?
I think for lawyers it can be hard, but I think at a macro level it doesn't need to be hard, right? Because I think it's fairly straightforward on this. I think you need to talk about what you're seeing and you need to listen to what you're saying, right? So you need to talk about what you're seeing when it comes to the way that these models are being used out in the wild. And I think, labs, as they are understanding their models' capabilities and they're seeing how users are using the models, they're the ones with the largest telescopes, the ability to see around the corner the most, and I think they have an important role to play in educating the public and the government in particular about how adversaries are using this technology, what it looks like, what the models are capable of doing, and all of that. And then I think you need to listen to everything you just said. And not sort of wish cast it away and say, well, this seems pretty long term, or that seems like a problem in the future, because the future is coming very quickly, and the ability to adopt and use these technologies is very simple, right? This is not training folks how to use some incredibly complicated technology, right? It's complicated to develop, but turns out not that complicated to use. And so the timeline between thinking that your models are capable of something and someone doing that thing is accelerated. In the report we released yesterday, I mean, that was one of our observations too, that, earlier in the summer we had predicted something like this would be happening, largely autonomous use of models to conduct sophisticated espionage operations, and less than 3 months later, we saw it. This is the kind of thing where traditional ways of thinking about risk tolerance and timelines for policy adoption are just not meeting the moment. And I think we need to think more iteratively about how we address this problem rather than trying to find a comprehensive solution at the front end. Necessarily. I think that would be ideal, but I think we also need to be realistic.
Yeah, and I had a quick follow-up on that. So we were discussing yesterday about the various offensive and defensive uses of AI and how it could be deployed. So what do you think are some of the greatest government challenges? You've had experience both in the private sector and in the government. What are some of the greatest challenges to the government in this AI race?
I mean, it's all the fun stuff, right? It's you know, not every part of the government knows what the other part of the government is doing. Not every part of one government agency knows what other parts of the government agency are doing, right? And this is an area where, again, information sharing is really critical. The other thing that I think is hard, and I know this having been a government lawyer for a while, it is hard to sort of, you know, turn the bit green and let folks start using things that you haven't fully thought about all the implications of. But I think, you know, to be blunt, this technology needs to get in more folks' hands in the government so that the capabilities and also the risks are better understood by the folks who have a responsibility for making policy and implementing policy for the government. So I think I think it just needs to be in more people's hands.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to, you know, in my recent experience in the government, I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges, echoing what Will is saying, is that this is a technology that almost entirely is developed, you know, in the private sector, with resources in the private sector, with the vast majority of technical expertise in the private sector. And so in a very real way, right, the government is learning from external, you know, entities who, you know, again, like, have their own private commercial interests, and needs to sort of integrate that into the way the government operates. And so you're sort of like, when you're starting from the government looking at advanced AI capabilities, you're already a little bit behind. And then on top of that, there are a lot of rules that currently exist to how the government can integrate and deploy artificial intelligence. There are sort of procurement issues, right? How do you procure systems for government use? There are rules in the intelligence community about how you use data, right? U.S. person data. And so one of the things that we worked on last year, right, was sort of an addendum or some additional guidance on how 12333 applies in the context of the use of large language models. And so there are all of these kinds of, I think, steps that need to be taken, both in terms of a technical understanding, but also in terms of reforming the rules and regulations and treatment of sort of what we have done within government, and now sort of thinking about how does this work in a different kind of paradigm, and sort of to pull ourselves forward. So just sort of building on what Will was saying in that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just had a very lively discussion in the earlier panel about AI deployment and drone warfare. And so we wanted to turn to Kat and helping us to understand, how do we manage AI deployment in conflicts? And what does AI mean in the civilian context versus the military and intelligence context? Are we able to manage these challenges in light of diminishing barriers to entry?
I mean, sure. I'd say, you know, I come from humanitarian law as opposed to being a combatant. So I want to put that on the table right now. I will not be talking to anybody about, like, how combatant command should be deploying its drone. But what I will say is that if we're looking at Ukraine, for example, right now, I think Ukraine is an incredible, it's illuminating in terms of what conflict may start looking like, the speed of it, the innovation, the gamification. You want to talk about innovation and transformation. It's astonishing when you start digging into what they are doing. I think what concerns me is that we can marvel at that use where we're kind of on that side and think, like, this is incredible, this is great. What does it look like when those same capabilities are sitting with Boko Haram, right? What does it look like when those same capabilities are sitting with, you know, militia or non-state actors all over the world? We never even figured out how to deal with law of war and cybersecurity. And now we're going to throw AI on top of it. And so when you think about in the rule of law in particular and what we have in the international order, one of the things I'm most concerned about is that the systems that we have to navigate this at a transnational level are simply not fit for purpose for the conflict that we are going to have, or the way that this technology is going to evolve in terms of peace and security. And so when you think about the differences, for example, between, combatant privilege for armed forces versus non-state actors, when you think about all of the messiness and the muddiness in terms of what is applicable and what is not. So think about state-sponsored proxy forces, think about private military contractors, think about cyber operations by non-state actors, think about transnational armed groups, think about hybridized conflict, think about, you know, is this militia drone operator sitting on the field in a uniform for a sustained amount of time? Like, probably not. That's probably not what we're looking at. And so I think this is something where we have to be prepared for a lot of use cases spinning up that far exceed what we are prepared to deal with in terms of our standard existing legal mechanisms. What I would also say, though, is in so many of these instances, what I truly believe is that mostly, and Will, this is sort of to your point, that doesn't mean that the fundamentals have changed about what we want to agree is acceptable and what we don't want to agree, what we don't want to agree is acceptable. So when we return to the fundamentals of why we even have the law of war to begin with, why we have humanitarian law to begin with, where are those things not contested values? Where are those areas where we still can reach agreement? And if so, I think the urgency to start thinking yesterday about how the diffusion of AI is going to fundamentally upend what that looks like, I think we need to figure out then very quickly how we take what that looks like and learn how to protect what we care about. And I don't think that that's impossible, but I do think that it means really being able to return to fundamentals at a core level.
Yes.
Just something to add on to that, because I think this idea of sort of AI diffusion is incredibly important, because as Will was sort of referencing, the time scale here is infinitely being shrunk down. And I was in Ukraine a month ago and got to see firsthand some of the small scale production capabilities where they're leveraging AI, they're leveraging their ability to sort of print in-house materials and make components to make drones. And that, I think, is massively problematic, not just in the context of third-party actors and non-state actors and our main adversaries, but it's problematic as this becomes general purpose use technology, where people in their garages are tinkering with it, toying with it, and they're increasingly able to do more and more, which can have a bigger, wider spread impact. And so that's something we're gonna have to learn to grapple with really quickly. And so I think this idea of really looking at sort of the basis of like, what are those standards that we can rely upon is incredibly important, but understanding the concept of how rapidly this is diffusing is incredibly important. It cannot be understated.
Can I just add to that quickly? Yeah. I think chemical warfare is another really good example, right? So what you're going to be able to do with AI systems in terms of learning how to actually create and combine the ingredients for chemical warfare and deliver them is going to escalate. So that just becomes much more broadly available. It's not like it was impossible to get to before, but you had to be highly incentivized, right? And pretty well trained. Now that barrier to entry has shrunk a lot. And so when you think about how our norms in terms of chemical warfare and the use of chemical weapons and also controlling the flow of those ingredients, how those have fallen apart, you can see that in that fragmentation, we create exponential risk for the scaling then of this possibility. Whereas if we actually had a stronger infrastructure for dealing with this at a base level, we would also then have a stronger ability to deal with the fact that it might be scaling. And so I just think in every single area where we see sort of fragmentation or breakage, assume that will be accelerating. And wherever that creates the highest risks, that's where I would say like you need to be doubling down now.
Yeah, absolutely. And Josh, returning to the idea of the race and how we win and how we lead, and the idea of energy policy being central to that, there are those that say the AI revolution demands an energy revolution, that without us being able to be as innovative in our energy policy as we are in our AI innovation policy, that we are not going to be able to succeed. I would love to hear your thoughts about how are we going to position ourselves for success over the long term.
Yes. So I want to start first with sort of an earlier question that was asked that I didn't get to chime in on, and that's sort of on the end state here. I think the U.S. really, the government has to start adapting these tools. China has already started implementing them across governments, so they're more interconnected, they are working more efficiently, and they are also using that, to tie this back into the question at hand, they are leveraging AI to develop energy resources. And that's something the United States really has to start looking at, again, not just looking at AI as sort of an LLM model, but the applications of it. And I was reading a report that came out of the University of Texas recently where leveraging AI and biotechnology, they are finding innovative ways for mineral extraction and energy extraction in ways that are not harmful to the environment. That is something that I think, so the applications here are something we have to look at, and we have to actually be open from a policy perspective to looking at innovative ways to do so. It's not just about green energy, it's not just about the environment, it's about energy dominance, and it's about actually ensuring that we can have a long-term sustained ability to actually implement the energy needs we need. That the United States is going to have if we're prioritizing AI in the right way. I was reading a report that AI data centers are projected to consume 12% of electricity within the next 4 years, and that right now we can't meet that capacity. And so we have to actually take steps to develop all forms of energy development. That's nuclear, that's natural gas, and so we have to continue pushing that. At the same time, we have to actually work to protect our energy grid. This gets overlooked often in this conversation, but it's something right now our energy grid is not secure. As AI becomes more diffuse and as our adversaries learn to use it more effectively, whether it's cyber operations, the vulnerabilities in our energy grid are going to become even more acutely visible. And AI is going to be, you'll be able to use AI, I fear, to actually identify how do we bring down the energy grid in a way that's diverse, hard to defeat right now. And so we have to look at energy security, not just energy dominance.
Yeah, thank you. The next question I wanted to start with, Will, and then open it up to everybody. But what are some of the national security risks to increasingly relying on automation of decision-making and the delegation of these type of automated systems in our national security systems? And also, what is the role of AI ethics as a cornerstone in making sure that we have human in the loop or human on the loop decision-making in national security? How do we have a frame of reference for national security risks that are not just the chatbot and these LLMs in thinking about second and third order risks? As well as some of the larger CBRN issues that Kat was raising.
So I think it's important to sort of hold two ideas in tension here, right? On the one hand, these are amazingly sophisticated tools that can upskill to a tremendous degree, particularly in areas like coding and various scientific disciplines, right? These are, and they're getting better every day, right? At the same point, they are not error-proof. Advanced AI has been very variously described in a number of ways. One description that one of our founders and CEO has put it as, advanced AI is a nation of geniuses in a data center, right? And anyone that's ever worked with geniuses know that they're brilliant, but sometimes they still make mistakes. Anthropic, a couple of months ago, released a report about a vending machine operation that we had at our headquarters where Claude was set up to basically run a convenience store. And employees could, use Slack and have Claude order various things for you. And it was fun and it was whatever. But then it got kind of weird. At one point it said, Claude said, I'm wearing a blue blazer and I'm in the lobby. I'm going to deliver your, items personally. Mm-hmm. And when an employee said, you're Claude, Claude got very concerned and started trying to contact Anthropic security because someone was impersonating an Anthropic employee, right? And so I think it's important to keep those two things in mind, right? These are amazingly sophisticated tools that, I'm at the point now where my day-to-day looks very different than it did a year ago because of the use of AI day-to-day. In the national security context, we've already seen some really strong adoption in the national security space, particularly with relation to, intelligence analysis, translating things, finding patterns, And those use cases are only going to grow. But given the risk of error in some cases, Anthropic, like most other frontier labs, have usage policies that are designed to mitigate the risk associated with the occasional error. And that's where, for particularly high-risk cases, our usage policy and others still requires a human in the loop. And I think a way to think about human in the loop is to think about what are the models capable of in a reliable and sustained way. And we will get there. I've no doubt. But first, we need to stop being the guy wearing the blue blazer in the lobby.
Anthropic has done such fascinating work, and one of the things I think we all benefit from in trying to understand the capabilities of these models, both for beneficial use, but also in terms of risks, is by sort of this safety and security testing that they do, and that oftentimes red teaming experts do of these models. I think the government has taken on some of that as well. I think it's useful to have some transparency around that from a governance perspective, so that both the government can understand those risks, which is sort of some testing that's being done out of the Commerce Department. And then sort of more publicly, we can also analyze the capabilities of models that are not American, right? So I think one thing that the NIST team did relatively recently was analyze the security and related capabilities of DeepSeek, and found that there are extraordinary safety and security problems with DeepSeek, which I think we all suspected, but it's like nice to have some empirical evidence behind that. And so I think that when we're thinking about these risks, the way we standardize and think about testing these models, and then how to be transparent about those risks from a governance standpoint is very important. And then I think there's sort of a question lurking in the background of this topic, which is like, what is the government's role in managing those risks? And is there something beyond transparency that should be occurring? And I think that's the very active debate right now. And I think there are a couple of different approaches to it. And when I think back to what we did in the executive order during the Biden administration, there was a focus on essentially a FLOPS threshold, right, 10 to the 26th, basically saying that's going to represent, the most capable models, and we're going to use that as essentially a rule of thumb to determine where we want to be more concerned about risks and capabilities and where we're less concerned about it. And I think that's a pretty rough approximation. I think over time, what we should look for are better ways to be precise about the kinds of risks that models present in different disciplines, whether that's chemical, whether it's nuclear, biological, cyber, and the like. And in part because I think that as models become more sophisticated, you don't need to be the biggest model to be the most to present the most risks in a particular space. You could be, a smaller, very well-trained model and present a particular concern, for biotech or something of that nature, right? And so I think there's going to need to be a lot of work done, both within the companies, within governments, and then within third-party testing, organizations, to figure out the best ways to analyze these capabilities as the models evolve.
Can I just add on to that as well? I think, one of the great things about lawyers is that we're word people, right? And we're dealing with an infantile lexicon right now in the way that we talk about these issues. So if you are sitting in a room and you're talking about human in the loop, right, and you're talking about accountability in, let's say, a national security system, and you're talking to an AI engineer, they will hear an entirely different thing than if you say accountability to a soldier or a lawyer. Right? Because the engineer will hear auditability. They will hear explicability. That is how they define accountability. The person who has to actually make a decision, who holds responsibility, right? They are hearing, where does the buck stop? Right? Who is accountable for the results of this decision? That is a fundamentally different conversation, and we don't entirely have different words for them right now. And so when we say things like human in the loop, I think one of the reasons that phrase has such traction is because it gives people a sense of comfort that we aren't deviating human judgment and agency from where we want it to be. I think what's important, though, on the flip side of that is to consider where are we actually really bad at stuff? And we've just been doing it because there was no other option. Human beings are bad at deciding a lot of things. And so when you think about where you want the human in the loop, I think there are also many areas where an AI system is going to be more predictable, more accurate, easier to understand, easier to vet, easier to change at a systems level than if you're trying to do it with a human or 1,000 humans or 10,000 humans. And so I do think it's very important, again, when we get into those conversations to question back to those fundamentals. If what you want is human agency and human judgment in how something is being deployed, what is the best way to get to that with these new approaches and these new systems? It doesn't necessarily mean that you're trying to have a human like look at every single decision an AI made, especially in something like a targeting environment where adversaries may not be doing that. And so this is just another area where I think lawyers can actually play a really important role, because we are all accustomed, I'm saying we. All I do is religiously pay bar dues to the New York Bar Association so that one day I can practice again if I want to. But I don't actually lawyer. So I want to credit to you all who do. So y'all and me, theoretically. I think one of the most important things that lawyers can bring to these questions and to these conversations right now is an understanding of the incentive structures, the values, the actual choices that you're trying to make, and how to narrate that and how to translate. Because that's fundamentally so much of what the job is in any respect, and AI is no different. It's just a new lexicon, a new understanding, a new vocabulary, and to some degree a new network probably of people who can sort of be your kitchen cabinet. But again, when I hear human in the loop, I've heard it's used so often, and I get so concerned that everyone has an idea in their head of what it means, and I'm not actually sure that that idea is what serves the goal that we have underpinning that for something like accountability or human in the loop.
Yeah, great. And I think that this is a theme that has come up a few times so far, but I wanted us to interrogate it a little bit deeper about energy policy. And thank you so much, Josh, for helping us to think about this with more clarity. But if we are in the middle of an AI cool war or AI cold war, how do we think about AI infrastructure issues? And there's been a lot of discussion about China's Belt and Road Initiative and building digital infrastructure in other nations as a form of soft power. And if we are going to take seriously this idea of a rapid scaling of data centers in order to support this AI innovation, what is the impact on national security if we fall behind?
So I think of this in kind of two different buckets, and that's opportunity and reward and risk. And on the opportunity and reward side, obviously we've got opportunity for economic growth directly related to the AI stack, directly related to sort of tech sales. We also have the opportunity for partnership, to the points that have been discussed throughout the discussion today. And we also have the opportunity and reward of productivity, increasing what we can do. Will sort of reference his day-to-day is drastically different, in part, I'm guessing, because of AI tools that he's using. On the risk side, there are geographic bottlenecks. There are geographic sort of single points of failure that are to be concerned, related to hyperscalers, data centers. If we have those sort of centered in one region versus another, how does that sort of disadvantage different parts of the United States? And then there's bigger questions related to sort of sovereignty. And this is a topic that's regularly coming up as I'm talking to international partners, mm-hmm. is how do they make sure that their citizens' data is being protected? This is something, there's a large contingent of folks here in the United States that are concerned about this. How do we make sure our data is staying somewhere where we trust it and not being used against us or against our future sort of generations? And then there's the question of oversight. Who's actually overseeing all of this? Who's kind of looking at the different private sector activities and making sure this is all working, to the point Kat made earlier, towards the values we are supporting? And so what's the role of sort of government, private sector, how do they sort of cooperate back and forth as this ball kind of gets tossed back and forth, all ties into the issue of this infrastructure. Fortunately, the administration right now is really prioritizing this. The plan they put out earlier this year really, I think, is going to incentivize, and I think within the next year, you're going to see a lot, not just conferences and meetings talking about this, but a lot of action plans actually putting money where the mouth is on this reindustrialization, prioritizing future tech, from semiconductors to biotechnology capabilities to the infrastructure itself and data centers. And as the lawyers think about the sovereignty question, I think that is going to open up additional opportunities for international partnerships with allies and trusted partners.
Thank you. So these next questions are to Will and Aaron, and that is, are we adopting too many policies and tactics from the older Cold War landscape that we once saw? Do we actually have the tools that we need right now? For example, are export controls working, or is it just incentivizing foreign adversaries to speed up and accelerate the innovation for them to catch up with us? And also, Aaron, who should lead in this policy? You've seen a lot of activity in the private sector, but also states have taken a real active interest in national security issues in the AI revolution. So we'd love to open that up.
Yeah. I touched on this a little bit before, but I think it seems fairly straightforward based on the available evidence that semiconductor export controls are one of the most effective tools we have to preserve strategic advantage here, right? There's been press reporting and studies done that have shown that, restrictions on semiconductors have materially constrained the Chinese Communist Party's work in this area. And I think that data sort of speaks for itself. It's rare sometimes that you can see the result of a policy outcome in that way, but I think we shouldn't blind ourselves to the reality when we see it. I think now is not the time to weaken that regime, to be very blunt, with new inference scaling techniques. Raw compute is not the only determinator of what's important here. And memory bandwidth, for example, is now critical. And so I think we need to look at those things as success stories that we ought to further capitalize on. At the same time, I think it's important that we focus on the entire stack, right? Semiconductors are one piece of that. Lab security, for example, to prevent model weight theft, is important. Closing loopholes through cloud access to some of this stuff where, users that you don't want using your product aren't able to access it through third-party platforms is, I think, important. And I think the government needs to be resourced to do all of this because this is all time-consuming, difficult work that at some point AI will help with, but right now, we're not there yet. And so resourcing the folks at BIS and others that are responsible for administering this work is, I think, important.
Yeah, and just in response to your other question, Margaret, I think that who has the institutional competence, who should be involved in these governance and legal questions is just as important as the what should the law be or what should the regulation look like. So even as we have conversations about, should AI be regulated? How should AI be regulated? Should there be export controls? Should there be transparency requirements and the like? There's sort of also the question of should that be coming from, the federal level? Should be coming from the state level? Should that be, being driven by the executive branch? Should it be driven by Congress? And I think, over the last year, when we've seen these conversations about, this proposed moratorium against state-level regulations of AI, like that sort of gets to the heart of it. What I've seen, at least in terms of, monitoring that, working with our clients, is that, there's very much, I think, a dialogue between what states are doing and then what they perceive federal interests to be. So on the federal level right now, there sort of seems to be a very, focus on deregulation, like let's sort of clear the road for innovation, right? And sort of some states want to follow along with that, but others are saying, hey, like there are certain areas where states do have you know, predominance where we have interests in protecting, let's say, child safety or protecting, you know, or allowing transparency for our consumers, for instance, of AI tools. And those are, you know, sort of, I think it's sort of creating almost organically sort of a new way of thinking about where the states should be laboratories, where the federal government should be, you know, the focus. And at the federal level, I think, you know, what's interesting is we saw a lot of ideas coming out of the last administration from the White House, often through executive orders, invoking IEPA and otherwise, that have migrated over to Congress, right? And so what's nice about that is that you see some actions coming out of the executive branch that then can make them their way into congressional discussion and debate and potentially into a legislative vehicle later on. And so, you know, I'll probably put my thumb less on the who should. I think sort of this is an everybody's involved kind of thing, which feels a little bit like a cop-out, but it's probably right. And then I think it's what's more important is that, you know, these institutions protect their own roles in the governance process. And I think, you know, work collaboratively so that where we don't end up is a situation where we either have no governance, which is, I think, you know, we probably all agree is a bit of a problem, but also governance that is not so burdensome or fragmented that it defeats the purpose or the objective of U.S., you know, innovation in this space.
Margaret, can I just, oh, I'm sorry, can
yes.
I, on the, just on the export controls from a foreign affairs standpoint as opposed to a sort of tech standpoint, I do think it's important to remember that the more that we constrain the Chinese development environment, the more that we make the Chinese development environment approximate the development environment of most other countries in the world. We're going to encourage scrappiness, we're going to encourage entrepreneurship, we're going to encourage innovation. And most use cases, right, and a lot of how AI is going to diffuse in countries all around the world, they're not looking for a Maserati, right? They want like a John Deere. And so that country that has developed, you know, or even a decent approximation of a John Deere, they might want a Lada. But that country that has developed the chips, the systems, the models that are good enough for a bunch of things is also going to have a tremendous advantage when it comes to diffusion. And so I think there is a careful balance to be struck in terms of where we try to put constraints on that environment and where we also get realistic about the fact that our development environment in the United States is wildly askew from where all other countries sit. And to some degree, that creates advantages, but it also, I think, can create some blind spots and some disadvantages in terms of what we prioritize. And so I just think that's an important component to have in the mix when we're thinking about export controls and constraint and what the longitudinal impacts of that will be.
Great, yeah.
So, on this, I push back just maybe a little bit, Kat. I think this kind of gets back into the sort of founding principles concept of the discussion. You know, from my perspective, and I think from a congressional perspective and executive perspective, it's in America's interest to ensure that American tools aren't powering the development of Chinese AI models. Is that something you would disagree with, or?
No. I think it's, I think it's a conversation we probably don't want to have as a binary also.
Oh, yeah.
That's all.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just one, because often I think that this can just very easily get lumped into two sides, and I think there is that sort of gray zone.
No, I think we I think so much of it comes to high risks, specific
absolutely.
Uses, specific capabilities.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.